Today, the Commonwealth Club of California, which is committed to the policy of hearing from the most competent speakers on the most controversial subjects, presents a discussion of whether or not our sex laws need basic reform. This challenging issue, which has recently received international attention, will be discussed by one of the world's outstanding experts in this area of social conflict and development. Dr. Carl Murdock Bowman was born in Topeka, Kansas on November 4, 1888, graduating from Washburn College in Topeka in 1909. He entered the University of California Medical School, from which he received his Doctor of Medicine degree in 1913. Dr. Bowman commenced his medical career with internships at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles and later at Seton and Roosevelt Hospitals in New York. His record includes 15 years as chief medical officer at the Boston Psychopathic Hospital from 1921 to 36, during which period he also served as an instructor and later as assistant professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. From 1936 to 1941, he was director of the Division of Psychiatry at Bellevue Hospital in New York, contemporaneously serving as clinical professor of psychiatry at the New York University College of Medicine. In 1941, he returned to California to become the medical superintendent of the then newly established Langley Porter Clinic, as well as chairman of the Department of Psychiatry of the University of California School of Medicine. He served in both of those capacities until 1956, and since then has been a professor of psychiatry emeritus at the University of California. A skilled specialist with a long list of professional honors and fellowships, he has contributed extensively to medical literature. Recently, the United Nations Organization published his paper on the subject, A Review of Sex Legislation and the Control of Sex Offenders in the United States of America, which paper was prepared for the International Review of Criminal Policy, a United Nations publication. During both World War II and the Korean Incident, if that be the proper term, he served as special consultant in psychiatry to the Surgeon General of the Army, advising concerning the treatment of psychiatric patients from the armed forces. Having headed a four-year study by a committee of the California legislature on the sex law problems of this state, Dr. Bowman's views today are those of a qualified expert. I present to the Commonwealth Club of California, Dr. Carl M. Bowman, who will speak to us on the challenging topic, should we abolish our repressive sex laws? Dr. Bowman.
This is my time here. Thank you, President Johnson. After that introduction, it's going to be awfully hard to live up to it, and I'm most likely to disappoint you. At the present time, we are seeing a definite breakthrough with discussion of the sex problem. For many centuries in Europe and the United States, there has been a sort of conspiracy of silence. No one can discuss this subject. And this cannot be talked about. Historically, the ancient Hebrew law made sodomy a capital offense. The Mosaic law, according to Golden, included only 36 capital crimes, and half of these concerned illegal sex relations. Three of these described unnatural sex relations, one between man and animal, two between woman and animal, and three between one man and another. The Christian religion largely took over the Jewish laws concerning sex behavior. Sodomy became the crime peccatum illud horribile inter Christianos, that abominable sin not fit to be named among Christians. The medieval ecclesiastic courts made sodomy, even when committed in secret, a serious crime. In early England, the guilty person was burnt or buried alive. By the time of Richard I, it was a practice to hang a man or drown a woman guilty of sodomy. With the separation of church and state, the English law on sodomy was changed several times. Once the penalty was even decreased. But in 1562-63, the original statute was made perpetual and was not touched again until 1861, when the Victorian statute reduced the penalty to life imprisonment. American colonial laws inherited the early English enactments, or English common law. We thus find that our laws regarding sexual behavior have been largely inherited from and mainly based upon the ancient Jewish code of over 2,000 years ago. It would seem, therefore, that it's time for us to reevaluate our thinking on this whole subject. To begin with, what practices shall we label normal and what abnormal or perverse? To what extent shall we try to regulate sex behavior by law? In this brief presentation, I can only touch on a very few points. First, I would raise the question, what is normal and what is abnormal sexual behavior? In a Muslim country, a man may have four wives at the same time. In the United States, he can have four or 40 wives, but not at the same time. In many countries, homosexual acts carried out in private by two willing adults are not a crime. In fact, in some European countries, for example, France, under the Code Napoleon, any sexual act carried out by two consenting adults which does not result in physical harm and does not offend public decency is not considered a crime. In contrast, our laws in the United States are highly restrictive to the individual. A great many types of sexual behavior are regarded not only as immoral, but as illegal and are punished by law. Here it is of interest to note that most of the highly praised books on marriage counseling advise and advocate sexual practices when desired by both partners, which are felonies in most of our states. In other words, we have the situation in which eminent persons in science, medicine, and even in religion advise married couples that they should, if they wish, commit felonies. Scientific observation shows that all the things labeled sex perversion are carried out among the higher mammals. To many investigators, it seems that man inherits from his mammalian ancestry some or all of these tendencies. Indeed, we all have many antisocial and undesirable impulses, not only along sexual lines, but towards murder, assault, theft, and so on. I would point out that many great writers have expressed this opinion. Bunyan stated, "There but for the grace of God go I." Goethe once said that he felt he had within himself the capacity for committing every conceivable crime. Society recognizes the universality of these undesirable impulses and passes laws against the carrying out of some of them. Religion labels some of them as sins. As for the sexual impulse, it has been said that biologically there is no such thing as a sexual perversion, and that all perversions are culturally determined. Likewise, the society in which one lives decides what sort of sexual behavior can be practiced and what type of sexual behavior will be forbidden by law. These forbidden practices legally are commonly referred to as perversions. At the present time, we have a revival of interest in this whole problem of sex legislation, and we note that there is a great desire on the part of many to modify the sex laws, some to make them more severe and some to make them less severe. We have honest differences of opinion about the propriety of certain types of sexual behavior. And where we do, it would seem that we should rely on education, family training, the influence of society generally, including religious organizations, as a means of dealing with such problems rather than bypassing laws. Our clearest examples of honest difference at the present time are with regard to birth control and the dissemination of knowledge regarding contraception. The recent pronouncement at the Lambeth Conference in England that sexual intercourse in marriage is a normal expression of love and affection and should be indulged in freely without necessarily leading to pregnancy is one example of what I have just mentioned. Another example, still concerning marital intercourse, is the statute which exists in two states in the United States forbidding a doctor to give advice regarding contraception to a married woman, even if he thinks the pregnancy might lead to the woman's death. This is perhaps one of the most extreme examples of the law seeking to interfere with the sex activities of married couples. We've had numerous attempts at modifying sex laws. A few years ago, New York passed a law that ordinary homosexual acts were no longer a felony, but merely a misdemeanor. California, at the same time, raised the penalty from a maximum of 10 years to a maximum of 20 years, and then later fixed a minimum of 1 year and a maximum of life imprisonment for anyone, and I quote the words of the statute, guilty of the infamous crime against nature committed with mankind or with any animal. End of quote. Perhaps it might well be that we should define homosexuality and homosexual acts. According to the dictionary, homosexuality is a sexual propensity for persons of one's own sex. The recent British Wolfenden report of the Committee on Homosexual Offenses and Prostitution insists that merely to have such a propensity is not a homosexual offense and cannot be legally punished. Legally, no state in the United States specifies homosexuality or homosexual behavior as a crime by those names or those wordings. Usually they talk about the infamous crime or the unspeakable crime or some other gobbledygook language. But I would point out that the federal government has taken a different attitude. In the armed forces, an inductee risks an undesirable or blue discharge because of not only homosexual acts, but of homosexual tendencies, and that such a discharge bars him from benefits or compensation or pension under regulations of the Veterans Administration. It may also prevent his getting a job. A recent directive in one branch of the armed service concerning the discharge of homosexuals and a subsequent review described such matters as very unpleasant and often disgusting. It stated that although homosexuals are security risks, moral risks, and their presence reflects unfavorably against the service, they must be disposed of justly. Two points must be decided in the individual case. Is the homosexual label justified? Is he a homosexual, whether or not he has committed a perverse act? I'd like you to note that wording. And if so, what type of discharge is suitable? In other words, we find that a psychiatric diagnosis of latent homosexuality may conceivably result in a type of undesirable or blue discharge. Since, as I have pointed out, some degree of homosexual impulses is present in practically everyone, it is fairly easy to label a large percentage of our population as latent homosexuals. Homosexuals are often classified as latent or overt. It seems extremely far-fetched to speak of an individual who has had a few homosexual experiences in childhood or adolescence as an overt homosexual, particularly if as an adult he is leading a completely heterosexual life. Yet this has been reported as occurring in the newspapers and resulting in the discharge of persons in the federal service. The latent homosexuals can be divided into two groups. The first consists of those who consciously desire homosexual relations, but carefully control these impulses in the same way that many persons desire heterosexual relations, but carefully control such desires. As, for example, many young women with normal heterosexual desires are virgins. The second group consists of those who, at a conscious level, have no interest in homosexual relations and even react with disgust to such an idea. However, they do have strong homosexual drives at an unconscious level. Their behavior is often motivated by these drives, which come out in disguised fashion. It is clear, then, that the term homosexuality does not describe a simple homogeneous group. You could even include some of the homosexual prostitutes who are not homosexuals at all, no interest in homosexuality except as a way of getting money. From a legal standpoint, I would agree with the Wolfenden report, which states that homosexuality per se is not an offense and that all laws and regulations should accept this conclusion. I also feel that legal procedures should consider only persons who have committed homosexual acts. There is much controversy of the cause of homosexuality, and I can't go into that deeply here. Suffice it to say, there is work by such men as Kalman with identical twins suggesting a hereditary factor. There is the work by various endocrinologists showing at times such a factor. There is the psychological approach and the views of Freud, who considers that homosexual impulses are a part of the normal state in the evolution of the sex instinct through which everyone passes. And I would like to quote you just a passage from a letter which Freud wrote to a woman in America regarding her son. "Homosexuality is assuredly no advantage, but it is nothing to be ashamed of, no vice, no degradation. It cannot be classified as an illness. We consider it to be a variation of the sexual function produced by a certain arrest of sexual development. Many highly respectable individuals of ancient and modern times have been homosexuals. Several of the greatest men among them, Plato, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and others. It is a great injustice to persecute homosexuality as a crime, and a cruelty, too. If you do not believe me, read the books of Havelock Ellis." Others emphasize the early conditioning experiences in life, the relationship of a child to mother and father, the way in which he may have been initiated into sex relationships, and many other factors. We see, therefore, that homosexuality may arise on a variety of causes. It seems probable that the tremendous emotion often aroused against homosexuality is largely due to the stirring up of the critics' own repressed and latent homosexual impulses, that therefore many persons who can discuss murder and other serious crimes in a calm, intelligent manner cannot discuss homosexuality without becoming highly emotional. I would like to make the following conclusions about homosexuality as well as other so-called sex deviations. Society has the right to protect itself against behavior which it feels is a crime against the peace and dignity of the state. The question is, where do we draw the line and when should the state pass laws regulating sex behavior? Society should be and is most concerned about two things: sex crimes of violence and sex crimes against small children. I think there is universal agreement that laws with strong penalties should be kept for these two offenses, and I know of no one advocating otherwise. The most controversial point is the problem of overt homosexuality. Here I would point out that in Great Britain and the United States, a number of medical and legal societies and some religious organizations have advocated less repressive laws. A report of the Lambeth Conference of the Church of England, the British governmental report, commonly known as the Wolfenden Report, the recommendation of the British Medical Society, all advocate that homosexual practices between two willing adults and carried out in private should not be a criminal offense. In our own country, the American Law Institute in May 1955, after considerable argument, voted 35-24 to recommend that sodomy between consenting adults, quote, be removed from the list of crimes against the peace and dignity of the state, quote. In the final debate, on the one hand, Judge John J. Parker opposed any change because he said many things are, quote, denounced by the criminal code in order that society may know that the state disapproves, end of quote. But Judge Learned Hand, one of the outstanding legal authorities in this country, speaking for the revision, stated that criminal law which is unenforced is worse than no law at all. He declared that, after having previously voted to retain this clause, he had now decided that sodomy is, and I quote, a matter of morals, a matter very largely of taste, end of quote, and not something for which people should be put in prison. I would, therefore, advocate that we should probably follow the code Napoleon, not only in the matter of homosexual acts, but as to other sexual acts of a heterosexual nature. I do not believe that bestiality, for example, a sexual contact between man and an animal, should carry a possible maximum penalty of life imprisonment as provided by the California statute. I would also advocate that the state has no right and should not seek to regulate the sexual behavior of married couples. Sending a married couple to prison because they were accidentally seen to be carrying out a so-called perverse act and placing their children in foster homes seems to me an unwarranted interference on the part of the state and something which should not happen, but which has happened in our state of California. Neither has the state, in my opinion, any right to interfere with the use of birth control by married couples or with the practice of medicine by physicians so that a doctor is not permitted to advise a married woman about the practice of birth control when pregnancy might even endanger her life. Here I would like to quote from the Lambeth Conference report. Sexual intercourse is not by any means the only language of earthly love, but it is in its full and right use the most intimate and the most revealing. It is a giving and receiving in the unity of two free spirits, which is itself good within the marriage bond and mediates good to those who share it. Therefore, it is utterly wrong to urge that, unless children are specifically desired, sexual intercourse is of the nature of sin. The report of a council of the Church of England, not for general publication, recognizes the fact that although homosexual acts are a sin in the eyes of the church, they are not necessarily crimes punishable by the state. In England, fornication and adultery are not sins, but are crimes, although they may well have much graver social consequences than do homosexual practices. It is therefore, I'm quoting from this report, it is therefore unjust that consenting homosexual men can be sent to prison if convicted under a criminal law which ignores both heterosexual sins and female homosexual acts. In England, there's no law against female homosexuality, only males. The present law, instead of protecting the young and preserving public decency, offers a chance for blackmail and may indirectly cause suicides. It also helps the homosexual by giving him a just grievance to ignore the moral implications of his act. For these reasons, the council urged an investigation of all possible revisions of the law. We have in the United States a considerable number of persons who wish to regulate by law the behavior and even the thinking of others. And we see a very strong growing tendency on the part of certain groups to pass more and more laws in this fashion. Personally, I agree with Thomas Jefferson, who said that government is best which governs least. The idea that the state should more and more regulate human behavior and human thought is, to me, getting away from the whole theory of democracy. I believe that a liberalization of the sex laws is desirable and is backed by some of the greatest authorities in the world. a proper modification of both our state and our federal sex laws, in my opinion, would be definitely beneficial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bowman, for opening the discussion on this controversial subject. And now, if you'll kindly return to the lectern, this is one occasion when the psychiatrist will answer the questions. And the first one, propounded by one of the members of the audience, refers to the Wolfenden Report. The question is, what has been the reaction in England, particularly among the clergy, the medical profession, and sociologists, to the Wolfenden Report, as released some months ago?
Well, as you doubtless would expect, it has not been a unanimous thing, but I would point out that the British Medical Association had already passed a resolution in favor of this very thing, so I think we can say that by and large, the medical profession was definitely in favor of it. As far as I know, the clergy of the Church of England have thoroughly supported it. I have been outside this country for the last 4 months over in Thailand and haven't seen much of the news and know what may have come up with regard to that. Most of the reports that I have seen, and since I've been back, I've been able to read some of them, in the British newspapers and elsewhere, seem uniformly favorable. I haven't read enough to answer that question adequately, however.
Coming closer to home, these two questions. What recent trends or developments have you encountered in the thinking of our California legislators concerning sex law? And secondly, this one. Should a California committee be appointed to study changes needed in our sex laws and to make recommendations to the legislature, similar to the Wolfenden Report in England?
Since our sex research stopped, I think it was July 1st, 1955, I have had no contact with the legislature on the problem of sex laws, and I don't know of any specific opinions they may have expressed, and since I've retired, I have been up to Sacramento very much less. I would say that I think there should be a serious study by some qualified group here in the state of California going over this whole problem and making recommendations. You obviously will not get any unanimous report on many points, but you probably will on quite a number. And this is a highly controversial subject, laden with a great deal of emotion, and I think our laws are so bad now that the first step is to have some discussions, some study, and decide what is the best way of modifying them. I've made some suggestions myself about it, but I think the best thing would to have some impartial committee that would command the respect of the state to study this matter.
Now, relating again to a topic which recently has been the subject of study by a legislative committee, this question: is there any substantial evidence that sex crimes are caused by reading or looking at so-called pornographic literature?
I would say there is practically none at all, and the great effect of salacious literature is highly overestimated by many zealous supporters of purity in our midst. As Kinsey has pointed out, among the female sex, you can get almost no interest whatsoever in pornographic literature, so that you knock off 50%, a little over 50% of our population already. And I think it is the person already inclined that way who collects pornographic literature and immerses himself in it, and that he would find some way of carrying on in much that fashion, whether you had the pornographic literature or not. And then you want to know, what is pornography? And if you look over recent court decisions, if you can find any agreement as to what is pornography, I'd like to see it, because they don't agree. And the attempts, as you perhaps know, to keep what is generally admitted as pornography, pornographic literature and material outside of the United States, for example, the institute at Kinsey's Institute, they held up a bunch of pornographic material from Japan, and finally the courts decided that the scientist had the right to study all phases of the sex problem, that he couldn't obviously study and give an intelligent opinion if he didn't know all the sides of the question. And the material has been admitted, and I saw it the last time I visited the institute there at the University of Indiana, and I must say I don't see why anybody bothered about trying to hold it out, because it had almost nothing very pornographic about it.